Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 146. It's Monday, January 10th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, this week, COVID-19 hospitalization rates will be smashed. The litany of "this is mild" as far as the Omicron variant goes is going to be a distant memory soon enough. It pains me to see. It's almost not even just a rejection of science. It's almost a rejection of causality. To say that cases don't lead to more hospitalizations and hospitalizations don't lead to more deaths. Now, of course, there's going to be less hospitalizations per case, and there may very well be less deaths per hospitalization. But I can guarantee you there will be a rise that'll be roughly proportional to each. And they're going up. So these so-called mild hospitalizations will likely be followed by record levels of death. Okay, and we're seeing that definitely in areas first hit with Omicron, such as New York City and the District of Columbia. Hospitalizations are now increasing faster than cases. This is what you see with the lag. Not surprising. Okay, well, the bad news really in all of this is the level in reaching capacity limits. So as hospital systems reach and exceed their capacity for so-called regular or normal levels of care, death rates will spike. We have about 1 in 4 hospitals now that are officially considered in critical capacity levels. Of course, officially means based on the beds that are on the books, which may be a little bit of an overestimate of available beds because staffing levels have been taxed so recently. So the thing is, when we get to those critical levels in those regions, you're going to see increased levels of death per hospitalization, just because they can't take care of people as well. And add on top of that, worse yet, the so-called normal deaths from other causes that happen in the course of life and healthcare. These normal deaths, the baseline level of deaths, is actually going to increase because there will be less healthcare staff available to take care of them. Of course, you also have the layer of if you go into a hospital that's full of COVID folks, you're going to run into potentially the virus within the hospital setting, those so-called nosocomial infections. That's infections that you pick up in the hospital. Okay, well, part of the problem this is we have to remember that we are going into this winter surge with hospitals stretched thinner than where we were when we started last winter's surge. And of course, part of this problem is that we have more of a people shortage, more so than beds or equipment that we've seen in earlier waves. Okay, well, I wanted to make one sort of correction from last week. I have a little bit of regret on a story that I reported. I reported on remdesivir that if you gave it outpatient, that it really decreased the chance of hospitalizations. This is true, but what I really forgot was that when they're talking about outpatient, Remdesivir has traditionally been used in the hospital. When you're in the hospital, you have an IV. If they want to give you a drug, they just give it to you through the IV. No problem. But if you're outpatient and you want to get some IV, that's a lot more difficult. So this remdesivir is not like a pill, like an oral steroid that you take for 3 days in a row. You actually have to go in 3 days in a row, three separate days, and get an intravenous drip of remdesivir. And this remdesivir is expensive, both the drug itself and, of course, the way you administer is a lot more expensive if it has to be IV on three separate occasions on 3 days in a row. Okay, so remdesivir, of course, in an outpatient setting is not going to be any great silver bullet for stopping this pandemic. It's one thing you can do, but it's going to be very limited in what we're able to do. Okay, well, now I'd like to turn to the next four stories, which are really themed as addressing the social fabric as it is in this country and how it affects our ability to respond to the virus. I had this realization this week that the American social fabric is really less of a fabric than it is confetti. This is perhaps appropriate coming out of the New Year's season. So rather than having fabric, we have all these atomized little pieces. We throw these up in the air, have a little party, woohoo! Everything's wonderful. They fall to the ground and get swept up as trash. And of course, you find these little pieces of our social fabric around the after effects, I imagine, in this metaphor, for months or even years to happen. So let's go with these stories. An epic conflagration in the Supreme Court. This from Stat News. Supreme Court skeptical of Biden's workplace vaccine rule. Fully vaccinated and mostly masked, the Supreme Court's conservative majority appeared skeptical last Friday of the Biden administration's authority to impose a vaccine or testing requirement on the nation's large employers. The court seemed more open to a separate vaccine mandate for most healthcare workers. The arguments in the two cases come at a time of spiking coronavirus cases because of the Omicron variant. And the decision last Friday by seven justices to wear masks for the first time while hearing arguments reflected the new phase of the epidemic. An eighth justice, Sonia Sotomayor, who has had diabetes since childhood, didn't even appear in the courtroom, choosing to remain in her office at the court and take part remotely. Two lawyers representing Ohio and Louisiana argued by telephone after a recent positive COVID-19 test, state officials said. But the COVID circumstances did not appear to outweigh the views of the court's six conservatives that the administration overstepped its authority in its vaccine or testing requirement for businesses with at least 100 employees. Roberts, Kavanaugh, and Barrett seemed to have fewer doubts about the healthcare vaccine mandate. Kavanaugh said it was, quote, very unusual situation, end of quote, that hospitals and healthcare organizations affected by the regulation were, quote, not here complaining about the rule, but instead support it. Quote, what are we to make of that? Kavanaugh asks. Very good question. Justice Neil Gorsuch was the only justice to remain unmasked throughout the arguments, which lasted more than 3.5 hours. He sits between Barrett and Sotomayor. The court did not explain why Sotomayor didn't take the bench. Well, you have to make your guess. Okay, this is a really stunning because of the disconnect between the realities that are palpable in the world and in the literal courtroom. We have these esoteric, I dare say, academic principles that are in stark contrast to the real world. We have to realize that now with the Omicron variant raging through the U.S., the United States is actually the epicenter in the world for Omicron cases. And D.C. was basically the first big spike, along with New York City. So D.C. is basically the epicenter of the epicenter, where the Supreme Court justices are meeting. And, of course, I'm not surprised that somebody who has an underlying condition like Sonia Sotomayor, that she did not feel completely comfortable sitting hours and hours and hours in an indoor situation right next to somebody who's unmasked, even though they all are fully vaccinated and actually they're all boosted as well. But we know that even boosting only gives you about a 70% protection against infection. And of course, Supreme Court justices tend to be older than the average population. Okay, well, the bottom line, I think, of this is that our court and perhaps our justice system as a whole, because it relies so much on precedent, is perhaps not well prepared to deal with unprecedented situations. And unfortunately, not only does this leave us in much greater danger in the present state we're in and in the near future, it likely makes us less prepared for the next pandemic or similar unprecedented situations that may come down the line. Okay, well, sticking to the theme of our social fabric in this country, this from Medical Express. More trusting societies have been more successful at reducing coronavirus cases and deaths. Countries where people have more trust in each other have been more successful in bringing down waves of coronavirus cases and deaths, a new study shows. Researchers found there is a threshold effect in nations where at least 40% of people agree that, quote, most people can be trusted. This supported effective reduction of cases and deaths during 2020. Analyzing coronavirus data during 2020, the researchers found more trusting societies tended to achieve a faster decline in infections and deaths from peak levels. This is likely because behaviors vital to stopping the spread of COVID-19, such as mask wearing and social distancing, depend on mutual trust to be effective. Professor Lenton, the chief researcher, said, "Our results add to evidence that trust within society benefits resilience in epidemics. Building trust within communities should be a long-term project for all nations, because this will help them cope with future pandemics and other challenges such as extreme events caused by climate change." Resilience to COVID-19 varied by a factor of 40 between countries for cases per capita and by a factor of 25 for deaths per capita. All countries where more than 40% of respondents agreed that most people can be trusted achieved a near complete reduction of new cases and deaths. So did some less trusting societies, indicating that trust in each other is only one of several factors at play. Looking across countries, the researchers found no significant correlation between trust in government and success at bringing down cases and deaths. Wealth and associated healthcare helps, but it is less important than trust in each other. So there's been a focus on the fact that we don't trust the government, but the fact is we're in our divided society. It's not hard to see that we really don't trust each other. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real. And our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, well, next up in this series of articles about social cohesion and social fabric in the U.S., this from Stat News. Protect our hospitals might convince Britons to get COVID-19 vaccines, but it won't work in the U.S. The resurgence of COVID-19 is again leading healthcare systems across the globe to brace themselves. And with deep scars from early in the pandemic, leaders are again calling on people to get vaccinated. One prominent reason they cite for vaccination is to protect hospitals and healthcare workers. In the U.S., this message is not working. In his recent speech to the nation, President Biden pleaded, "Let me say again and again and again, please get vaccinated. It is the only responsible thing to do. Those who are not vaccinated are causing hospitals to become overrun again." A day earlier, Dr. Anthony Fauci described a very strong urge to get people vaccinated because there will be a big stress on the hospital and healthcare system. In Cleveland, six medical systems took out a striking full-page newspaper ad to beg help. These messages are collectivist in principle, but also appeal to self-interest. Protecting your own hospital and its workers means they will be available to see you if you get COVID-19. While such a message seems to fall on deaf ears in the U.S., it appears to resonate elsewhere. In the U.K., for example, which began seeing the effects of Omicron ahead of the U.S., officials from England's prime minister to managers of top soccer clubs have called on the public to protect the National Health Service, the NHS. The NHS, or National Health Service, is the UK's taxpayer-funded, government-run health system. Although it is impossible to attribute success to a single message, England has been vaccinating people at a rate 3 to 4 times greater than the US since mid-December. The British loves the NHS. People who use it pay little or nothing at the point of care, and it is among the highest-performing healthcare systems in the world. In fact, more than half the population identified the National Health Service as the thing that makes them most proud to be British, above the armed services, the royal family, and the BBC. It is held in such high esteem culturally that it was featured in the opening ceremony of the 2012 Summer Olympics in London. Most of the criticism of the NHS faces is about underfunding. More than 3/4 of the public wants funding for the NHS protected above all other government activities. During COVID-19, this concern heightened into public worry about whether services would be available. UK residents know that COVID-19 can overwhelm the system they rely on and want it protected. That loyalty is what makes a message like protect the NHS ring true. The system is nearly universally seen as a public good and in need of protecting. Most people in the UK understand that getting vaccinated benefits the NHS precisely because the public has an equal stake in its success. An unvaccinated person who ends up in the hospital takes resources such as beds, doctors, and nurses away from others. In the U.S., we may like our doctors, but are not loyal to the healthcare system. Many Americans valorize the doctors and nurses working on the front lines of COVID-19, but you would be hard-pressed to find someone who wants to protect the medical groups, HMOs, and other complex insurance convolutions undergirding our system. In fact, just 19% of the public believes the healthcare system works at least pretty well, less than every other country studied. I'm going to repeat that one again. In fact, just 19% of the U.S. public believes the healthcare system works at least pretty well. Yikes. That lack of loyalty in the system is reasonable. Many families, even those with health insurance, have been financially harmed by a system they pay increasingly unreasonable amounts of support. In 2019, about 20% of Americans with private insurance reported being contacted by a collection agency about a medical bill. And nearly 60% of all people in the U.S. who declare bankruptcy identify medical expenses as a contributor. This is unheard of in most other high-income countries. It is also difficult for the public to justify protecting a healthcare system that has, in parts, profited from the pandemic. The 5 largest private health insurance plans in the nation made more than $11 billion in profits in early 2021, after record profits a year earlier. And some private wealthy hospital systems reportedly made millions of dollars, and a few made billions in the past 2 years. Some might reasonably ask, what exactly needs protecting? Perhaps Americans' trust in their own physicians will outweigh attitudes towards the larger healthcare system in making vaccine decisions. But without underlying fixes to the healthcare system that create a recognized, legitimate public good, broad vaccine messages about protecting our hospitals and healthcare system may continue to give Americans little reason to act. Another main reason how our untrusting social fabric harms us all. Well, this last little story in this litany on our social fabric is from Stat News, and it's called Confessions of a Human Guinea Pig, Why I'm Resigning from Moderna Vaccine Trials. And this is a long personal story, might be worth reading. I'll give you the link at the end of the show for the stories you can read online. But I just wanted to read the last paragraph, which really sums it up. While the process of science and the products it yields are noble, science for outrageous profit that costs people their lives is not noble. This is why I can no longer in good conscience be part of Moderna's trials, and I urge other Moderna trial participants to resign as well. We allowed Moderna to test its experimental vaccine and booster on us in order to help end this pandemic, not to make more pharma billionaires. Yikes. Well, I don't know if I'd encourage people to quit the trials, but it is definitely a conundrum. And this is a good example of what I've talked on the show many times before about moral injury. When you're trying to do something good and you're in a system that thwarts your ability to do good, it creates a psychological injury, moral injury. And our healthcare system is a major cause of moral injury for a lot of help bearers, a lot of people who want to do good, people who want to do a lot of healing, and our healthcare system just gets in the way. Okay, well, I wanted to finish off this litany of stories about the social fabric with a quote. How do communities survive disasters? Despite what our favorite apocalyptic books and movies may have us believe, the research shows that the communities that come through disasters the best are those that work together, share their resources, and make sure no one is left behind. I'm going to read that again because that closely aligns with what I'm trying to do here with this show. The research shows that the communities that come through disasters the best are those that work together, share their resources, and make sure no one is left behind. May it be so in our nation. Well, you're listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, I want to do a couple stories on testing before we get to the local COVID-19 update. First up from Stat News. Study raises doubts about rapid COVID test reliability in early days after infection. I think that with every new variant that comes, scientists have to question whether the things that were previously true are still true, said Blythe Adamson, the lead author of the paper and principal epidemiologist at Infectious Economics in New York. This one has a different way it travels, a different mechanism of action of symptoms. It has different windows of transmission. The results mean that rapid tests, both Abbott's Binex Now and Quidel QuickView, aren't catching people during their first couple days of infection. We know that PCR tests are more sensitive than antigen tests. This is not new information, Abbott Laboratories said in a statement. We also know that PCR tests are so sensitive that they do not indicate infectiousness, and thus are not a practical tool for keeping the workforce and economy moving. Despite the small sample size in this study, the results are remarkably consistent. Not a single rapid antigen test detected the virus until nearly 2 days after the initial positive PCR result. Additionally, the cases of infection from people who had received false negative results could raise alarm bells. Daniel Larimore, an assistant professor of computer science at the University of Colorado Boulder, who has studied COVID testing, said the results show rapid tests are not catching cases during the first days of infection. Meanwhile, people are facing hours-long lines for PCR tests and multiple-day waits for results. The results strongly suggest that we will be unable to effectively test our way out of the current surge, even if we each had a week supply of rapid tests on the counter, Larimore said. He was not involved in this particular study. However, many emphasize this does not mean that rapid antigen tests are not useful. The tests also detected the virus in every case. It just took longer than with PCR. So while the test may not work as an early warning, a positive test result at home does likely mean that the person taking the test has COVID-19. And to get in the weeds a little bit more about testing, this also from Stat News. Containing COVID-19 requires rapid tests that are highly sensitive to infections. Why is the FDA asking for something different? New FDA guidelines now say that rapid COVID home tests should have at least 98% specificity, that's less than 2% false positives, but can have as low as 80% sensitivity, that is 20% of false negatives. That's consistent with tests currently on the market, most of which have high specificity, but sensitivity in the mid-80s to the low 90s range. So again, this is kind of complicated. The specificity, which is the indication of how many false positives, means that if you are truly positive, the tests have a 98% chance of identifying that, and only 2% of the positives that the tests show up are actually negatives. And the sensitivity is how sensitive it is to actually picking up a positive case in the first place. So in other words, if you had 100 people that were truly positive and they test, 80% sensitivity would mean that 80 of those would be picked up, and that 20 of the people that weren't picked up would be false negatives. And this is kind of the problem. So, okay, on with the story. Well, that's the wrong way to go. A key to containing the impact of COVID-19 is early detection and early treatment. This calls for highly sensitive tests, so positive cases aren't missed. Everyone who takes a rapid COVID-19 test before getting together with others, whether in an office, at home, or on a football field, wants to be as confident as possible that a negative result is a true negative. Those who are at high risk of severe consequences if they become infected, such as the elderly and those who are immune compromised, are particularly concerned with the accuracy of negative test results. They should be able to choose a test that is extremely sensitive, which reduces the chance of false negatives. Yet, the FDA is doing the opposite, encouraging tests with low sensitivity, which will often falsely tell people infected with SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, they are negative. This is unwise. It should be easy to see the value of distributing billions of highly sensitive COVID tests to a nation of nearly 330 million people who need to routinely test themselves for COVID-19. A negative test can give reassurance. Those who test positive can isolate themselves to prevent spreading infection and, if needed, get early treatment. Well, and under the category of why didn't somebody think of this before, I'll get to an article that I'm including in my bonus articles that you can read online. The Biden administration rejected an October proposal for free rapid tests for the holidays, which would have been exactly what this article is saying we needed. They declined to do that. You can get that article and others that I'll list at the end of the show from toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. So with where we are now, we're not going to be able to test our way out of this epidemic. That's just the reality right now.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times. But I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me. But the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, it's time for the Lucas County COVID-19 update. What's happening locally? Well, in the last week, we went from 527 identified cases per day over 7-day average to 903. 527 to 903. Yikes. And now, Lucas County's case rate and death rate, for that matter, are actually higher than Ohio's. This has not been the case in the recent weeks and months. So that is a shift. Now we're doing worse than the state as a whole. Well, our testing positivity rate locally is 29.3% in the most recent iteration of that. In Ohio, it's 27.5%. Oh, I would note that on the CDC site, they use often when they're doing local or state positivity tests, they just put greater than 25%. Partly because once you start getting above like 25%, it's kind of crazy. Your testing sort of maxed out. But I suppose the good news is that in Ohio, we have had record amount of testing that's been done. So that's a new record. So it's good that we're actually doing some more testing, but not nearly enough to make up for the testing shortage. And the U.S. positivity rate, the entire nation as a whole, jumped from 17.1% to 28.9% in the most recent 7-day period. Oh my goodness. Okay, well, looking at long-term care facilities in Lucas County, in nursing homes, we did see a bump up to 103 active cases from 69 in the previous week. That was 30 residents and 73 staff. But the good news is we didn't have any additional deaths reported. Okay, well, hospitalizations continue to set new record levels in Lucas County and Ohio, although they're actually rising faster in Lucas County than Ohio as a whole. Deaths, which have been cruising along at 1,500 deaths per day on average pretty consistently over the last couple weeks, is starting to tick up and expect it to spike here in these next couple of weeks. Currently, meaning the last couple weeks that we have data, the Lucas County death rate is higher than the Ohio rate and over double the national rate of death. Well, we're seeing that we're getting a slow increase in people that are fully vaccinated, moving 0.4 or 0.5% of the population locally in the state or nationally. The good news as far as boosting is that Ohio's actually doing a better job of boosting people who've been fully vaccinated, with almost 25% of the population being fully vaccinated and boosted, whereas that's only 21% of the population in the U.S. Of course, in the U.S., that means that about 89% of the people do not have much, if any, protection from Omicron transmission. The full vaccination status will give you a lot of protection from severe disease, but as far as from transmission itself, it doesn't offer much. You really have to get boosted to get a boost of transmission prevention. Okay, well, if all this is taxing your mental health, maybe it's a good time to talk about some mental health stories. One that relates to COVID-19, and then some more general ones. This from The Nation's Health, a publication of the American Public Health Association. Mental health workforce taxed during COVID-19 pandemic. Worker shortage hinders access. Faced with loss, stress, and never-ending uncertainty, the mental health of Americans has suffered during the COVID-19 pandemic. And at a time when mental health services were desperately needed, staffing shortages and barriers to access have complicated care. Studies suggest that over 125 million Americans have struggled with mental health issues during the pandemic. Household surveys administered in 2020 by the CDC found that 38% of adults were experiencing anxiety or depressive symptoms, up from 11% in 2019. Almost 83 million people diagnosed with anxiety or depression were unable to access counseling services in 2020, a study published in June in Psychiatry Online found. About 43 million people with undiagnosed anxiety or depression had an unmet need for counseling, double the annual number in recent years. Shortages in mental health services are widespread across the U.S., with the most underserved areas in Middle America and the South, according to data from Health Resources and Service Administration. The shortages impact an estimated 132 million Americans. More than 6,600 mental health practitioners are needed to fill vacancies. Even before the pandemic, a years-long contraction of services due to budget cuts and turnover were creating a crisis. What began as a recruitment and retention problem among psychiatrists spread during the pandemic to other licensed professionals in behavioral health, said Brian Hepburn, Executive Director of the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors. Some people who work as nurses, counselors, psychologists, and clinical social workers transition to higher-paying jobs with better benefits. Meanwhile, a chunk of the workforce is retiring and not being replaced, as many positions in the mental health profession pay modestly and can be stressful. People used to take a lot of pride in working in healthcare, Hepburn told the Nation's Health. They came in with a certain idealism. They were doing something to help people, so they accepted lower wages. But that has all changed. A bright spot nationwide for the field has been virtual delivery of mental health services. In 2020, many providers moved their caseloads to telehealth, representing a 40% rise in virtual appointments compared to 2019. Health advocates, including the American Public Health Association, are urging federal and state regulations that made that expansion possible become permanent. Broadband access is needed for telehealth, and most states have coverage holes. Adaption and innovation have continued in the mental health care field, causing hope among some stakeholders that a corner has been turned. For example, there has been a growth in community services and mobile crisis teams, which are dispatched instead of law enforcement to handle mental health crises. In addition, more high-tech crisis call centers have been established, and a 988 mental health hotline is set to go live nationwide in July. Callers will be connected to certified suicide prevention call centers, which can dispatch local mobile crisis teams. Stabilization services will also be available.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, sticking with the mental health theme and also the social fabrics theme from earlier, this from the Nation's Health. Sports betting exploded in Maryland in 2020 thanks to a new state law that allowed a range of online and in-person betting options at sports stadiums, horse racing tracks, state fairgrounds, and six casinos, including one on a riverboat. The Maryland law is not an outlier. Across the U.S., states are looking for new revenue sources and betting companies are ready to set up shop. But mental health and addiction professionals worry the expansion could create or worsen gambling disorders, which already affect millions of Americans. In a given year, about 2% of people in the U.S. engage in problem gambling behaviors. In my view, the relationship between gambling and public health is similar to its relationship with alcohol, said Rachel Volborg, a gambling addiction researcher at the University of Massachusetts Amherst School of Public Health and Health Sciences. Gambling, for the most part, now is a legal but risky consumer product. In 2018, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned a federal law that prohibited most states from legalizing sports betting. Since then, all but a few states have considered allowing the practice. In under 2 years, the number of states with legal sports betting accelerated from 1 to 31, in addition to the District of Columbia. Many people who live where sports gambling is now legal are eager to place bets. A September 2021 survey from the American Gaming Association found that a record high 45 million Americans plan to bet on professional football during the 2021-2022 season, an increase of 36% over last season. Nearly 20 million adults plan to place a bet online, a 73% increase from 2020, the survey found. Sports betting can be done anywhere in a legal jurisdiction, from a sports bar to the dinner table, all on a smartphone or other mobile device. Casino and sports-adjacent brands are investing in internet and mobile platforms as well as sleek advertising campaigns featuring celebrities and professional athletes. Everyone now has a casino in their pocket, Keith White, director of National Council of Problem Gambling, told the Nation's Health. One concern is that flashy, high-budget ad campaigns from gambling companies are now more common and targeting youth. According to Yale Medicine, which conducts research on gambling, as many as 7% of youth develop a gambling disorder, compared with about 1% of adults. Gambling can hold a special allure for disadvantaged youth, Volborg said. More than a dozen states now receive at least 10% of their general revenue from in-state gambling, according to the National Council on Problem Gambling. About 2 million U.S. adults are estimated to have severe gambling problems or addiction, according to the National Council on Problem Gambling. Up to 6 million more have mild or moderate symptoms. According to the American Psychiatric Association, gambling disorder involves repeated problematic gambling behavior that causes significant problems or distress. The disorder is classified as a behavioral addiction in the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic Manual. Problem gambling is more common in men, people of color, and in those with mood or personality disorders. People with psychiatric disorders such as major depression are much more likely to develop gambling problems, according to a 2008 study. Medication and therapy can help, but fewer than 10% of people with a gambling disorder seek treatment, according to the American Psychiatric Association. Well, you are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. Okay, two more mental health stories, this one from Medical Express. Teens with disabilities are 5 times more likely to suffer from mental, emotional, and behavioral health disorders. The pandemic has revealed some truths. A lack of mental health providers to sufficiently meet the needs of those in crisis, including providers of color, and the stress that COVID-19 has introduced is being felt by all ages, with mental health coping strategies being constructed to help. Another truth, young people with disabilities report poor mental health compared with peers without disabilities. According to a University of Illinois at Chicago researchers, teens with disabilities are up to 5 times more likely to suffer from mental, emotional, and behavioral health disorders than adolescents without disabilities. Kristen Berg, Associate Professor of Disability and Human Development at the College of Applied Health Sciences at the University of Illinois, Chicago, is tackling the latter issue as a co-principal investigator of their Behavioral Health Stratified Treatment, BEST project, a new $7 million 5-year study that will assess the integration of mental health services part of a state care coordination service instead of relying on referrals to mental health services. A lot of times, physical therapy and occupational therapy and speech therapy services are prioritized, Berg said. As a country, we haven't prioritized mental health care in the sense of affordable, easily accessible health care. For people with disabilities, that has been thousands of times more complex given access barriers and also the lack of providers in the mental health care world who are trained to deal with individuals with intellectual disabilities and autism. As a person with a disability, Berg said a variety of factors come into play when a family attempts to get care for depression or anxiety for a child with autism, from providers who say they don't treat intellectual disability to finding a provider who knows about particular disability issues to finding a provider with an accessible venue. Berg added that a lot of times when a person with a disability goes in for treatment, symptoms of depression or anxiety are blamed on the disability, when that's not always the case. Another challenge, recognizing that individuals with disability are more likely to experience trauma. In my own research, clinically or anecdotally, I heard many cases of individuals with disabilities being abused or neglected, Berg said. When people with disabilities come into the office, there is this medical model focused on their disability. They're just addressing those symptoms of that medical condition. A lot of times, behavioral health feels like it's in this other silo. Because of the siloing in training and in the profession, a lot of primary care physicians or specialists aren't trained in behavioral health. In the behavioral health workforce, they're not trained in intellectual and developmental disability. That's another factor that we see. These professions aren't dialoguing with people with disabilities who have comorbid depression or anxiety and are falling through the cracks. Jennifer Hernandez agrees. As a family nurse practitioner and a parent to a 14-year-old who has autism, Hernandez said it's been a battle since her diagnosis at 17 months with insurance, schooling, IEPs, and resources. You have a patient who has chest pain. They're on the table within 24 hours. You have a child who's having suicidal ideation. You go to the ER. You wait hours to be assessed, she said. This is how we're treating our children in this country. It's unbelievable and shocking, and it's sad. The emotional trauma that a family already goes through, and then you put this on the top. It's in everybody's best interest to intervene early and prevent the crises we're seeing now where kids are being hospitalized, going into residential settings. They're in the hospital for days with these mental health crises, which is far more expensive than if we get in there early and provide effective, brief cognitive behavioral therapy services, Berg said. We want to eliminate all these additional steps for families that are already stressed out and dealing with a lot of stuff. Integrating people with disabilities more generally into psychiatric and psychological therapy services. Adapting commonly used interventions like cognitive behavioral therapy and curriculum to be accessible for people with different types of disabilities is on the agenda for Berg's team of researchers, replete with disability stakeholders and investigators who have disabilities. Focus groups will advise on language, activities, visual aids, and strategies on how it's implemented. Well, the best to them. And on the provider side with mental health, psychiatrists in the U.S. are adhering even more tightly to the medical model. This from Medical Express. Talk therapy by U.S. psychiatrists declined by half since 1990s. For decades, psychiatrists routinely used both psychotherapy or talk therapy and medication to treat patients. This is hardly the case anymore, according to a new study out of Columbia University. The switch to medication management has swept psychiatric practices. Researchers analyzing 21 years of data across the U.S. found that between 1996 and 2016, the percentage of psychiatrist visits involving psychotherapy had declined by half, dropping to only 22% of patient visits. By the mid-2010s, over half of U.S. psychiatrists no longer practice any psychotherapy at all, and that number has likely fallen more since then. The study, published in the American Journal of Psychiatry, finds that the decline in psychiatrists' provision of psychotherapy did not affect all patient groups equally. Older white patients in the Northeast and the West who pay for treatment out of pocket were impacted less by these declines and still retained access to a small class of psychiatrists who saw fewer patients, saw them more often, and were more likely to provide them with psychotherapy. For other patient groups, and in particular for younger, rural, Black or Hispanic patients, and those relying on public insurance to pay for care, receiving talk therapy from their psychiatrist has become exceedingly rare. One of the main drivers of these trends, the study suggests, is economic. Insurance companies have incentivized the provision of psychotherapy by counselors, social workers, and other mental health professionals who are compensated at lower rates compared to psychiatrists. From psychiatrists' own perspective, too, psychotherapy is less financially worthwhile. In the time span of a single psychotherapy session, psychiatrists can have multiple shorter medication management visits. For many psychiatrists, this helps pay their soaring medical school debt. The decline in psychotherapy administered by psychiatrists is worsened by a severe national shortage in psychiatric services. In places with poor access to care and where providers are overwhelmed by demand, psychiatrists are particularly unlikely to practice psychotherapy. By focusing on medication management and leaving talk therapy to other providers, psychiatrists working in lower access areas might feel they can reach more patients in need. These trends are likely to only have been accelerated by the COVID-19 pandemic, which significantly increased the demand for mental health services. Psychiatrists have long prided themselves on their mastery of both psychological and pharmacological treatment approaches, addressing both the mental and physical aspects of psychological problems, according to the American Psychiatric Association's website. Current official psychiatric guidelines instruct providers to treat many common disorders with a combination of psychotherapy and medications. Yet, according to senior study author Mark Olson, the trends reported in the study indicate that in practice, psychiatry is breaking away from psychotherapy, a modality of treatment that it used to be emblematic of it. In response to powerful economic incentives, U.S. psychiatrists have become increasingly focused on medication management, Olson said. This transformation risks leaving unaddressed difficulties that their patients have in their personal relationships, families, and work roles. And as may be typical, if you want to follow these trends, you need to follow the money. Okay, well, I'd like to switch gears now and do some stories on cancer and on disparities in cancer. First up, from Science Daily. Recent trends also highlight global disparities in cancer burden. Cancer deaths rose to 10 million and new cases jumped to over 23 million globally in 2019, according to a new scientific study from the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington School of Medicine. At the start of the decade in 2010, total cancer deaths numbered 8.3 million worldwide, and new cancer cases were at 18.7 million. The counts by the end of the decade in 2019 represent increases of 21% and 27%, respectively, of deaths and cases. Although the absolute burden of cancer increased in both deaths and new cases from 2010 to 2019, the global age-standardized mortality and incident rates decreased by 6% and 1%, respectively, for deaths and new cases. The small percentage declines globally are promising, but the researchers caution that there may be setbacks in cancer care and outcomes due to COVID-19. The effects of the pandemic on cancer morbidity, mortality, and prevention and control efforts were not accounted for in this study, which analyzed global cancer burden through 2019. The authors also analyzed cancer burden based on sociodemographic index, a composite measure of income per capita, average years of education, and total fertility rate for people younger than 25 years of age. While the global trend for age-standardized mortality and incident rates is encouraging, the reduction in rates appears to be driven by higher sociodemographic index locations. For mortality, age-standardized rates decreased in the middle-high and high quintiles and increased in the low and low-middle quintiles. Similarly, for incidents, the age-standardized rates decreased in the high, middle, and high quintiles, with the largest decrease in the highest quintile, while increasing in the low, low-middle, and middle sociodemographic index quintiles. So again, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. Okay, next up, some U.S. disparities in cancer. This from Medical Express. Considerable racial, ethnic, and sociodemographic disparities present in cancer. The overall cancer rate, death rate, is 19% higher for black versus white males. For females, the overall cancer death rate is 12% higher for blacks versus whites, despite their having an 8% lower incident rate. For all cancer combined, five-year relative survival was 14% lower for residents of poorer versus more affluent counties. And riffing to another disparity, this among black folks who are incarcerated, this from Medical Express. Incarceration associated with increased mortality rates among black individuals. A new study led by researchers at Boston Medical Center shows that black individuals who were incarcerated experienced higher mortality rates post-incarceration compared to non-Hispanic, non-black individuals who were incarcerated. Examined a national cohort that was followed over nearly four decades, the analysis identified that following incarceration, black individuals had a statistically significant 65% increase in mortality, whereas no statistically significant association was observed for non-black individuals. The researchers signaled that these results may impact the disparities in life expectancy between black and non-black individuals in the United States. The United States incarcerates a greater number and proportion of people than any other country in the world, with a dramatic increase in incarcerations in the last four decades. This exhibits as a form of structural racism because this increase has disproportionately impacted non-white groups, particularly black men. Prior research has shown that after incarceration, the initial process of transitioning back to life in the community is very stressful and a dangerous period where the risk of death is extremely high, particularly due to drug overdose, among many other health threats. However, few studies have been able to look at the long-term impacts that incarceration has on health over the years that follow. These results shed more light on the harms of the criminal legal system and structural racism, which we hope will embolden the public and policymakers to critically reevaluate what, quote, public safety means, whose safety really matters, and what type of policies could address the root causes of crime without causing harm to already marginalized communities. So again, just to highlight the heart of this study, incarceration did not increase the long-term mortality rate of whites, but it greatly increased it by over 60% among blacks. Yikes. Racism at work. Okay, well, I want to turn to the number one preventable cause of death in the United States, which is tobacco use. And here's an interesting little case study that shows how public health works and the difficulties of making it work. This from Medical Express. Cost-effectiveness of financial incentives for smoking cessation. From a societal perspective, paying people to quit smoking is highly cost-effective because the benefits of smoking cessation are so great. That's one of the main takeaways from a new study. At the same time, the study also helps us understand why employers might be reluctant to implement financial incentive programs in the workplace, given their shorter decision horizons and the fact that the benefits may accrue long after the employee leaves the company. Using the data from the trial, the researchers estimated life expectancy gains in life years, quality in life gains, which is in quality adjusted life years, healthcare costs, and employer costs. They compared two perspectives, the societal one, which includes all health gains and costs, regardless of the payer, over the participants' remaining lifetimes, and the employer one, which includes only costs paid by the employer over a five-year time frame. Their findings are eye-opening. Compared to business as usual, The incentive programs were quite cost-effective from a societal point of view, of $3,200 to $6,500 per life year, and that is actually an astonishingly good deal. And for quality of life adjusted year, that's $2,500 to $5,000 per additional year of quality life. But would implementing the program be a good business decision? From the employer's perspective, which also takes employee turnover into account, costs range from $250,000 to $1.7 million per life year. Because quality of life gains are larger than life expectancy gains in the early years, the cost per quality of life is much lower but still substantial, $65,000 to $129,000 per quality adjusted life year. The cost effectiveness improves considerably if employees use a longer decision horizon, such as 20 years, but it is not likely that a single employer will retain the employee for that entire time, meaning that the gains will accrue to a different employer. These findings explain why many employers may be reluctant to take on the substantial upfront costs of these effective programs, even though the eventual health payoff from quitting smoking is quite large. The author suggests that the cost of these programs might be shared between employers and insurers to make it more likely that they reach the people who wish to stop smoking. So this is a perfect example of the disjointedness of having to market solve these things. You have huge public goods. In other words, getting people to quit smoking, the cost involved is just hugely cost effective in the long run, but it's not cost effective for individual businesses. This is at the heart of securing the public good and why you need community-wide, societal-wide programs that ensure that the public good can actually be achieved and that we can buy these great deals in health, such as in cigarette smoking. Okay, well, lastly, I want to close on a story. Since it's New Year's resolution time, I want to do this story from Medical Express. Resolve to quit smoking this year? Experts offer tips. If giving up tobacco is one of your New Year's resolutions, know that it won't be easy, but don't give up. 50 million ex-smokers in the United States are proof that it can be done. More than 70% of smokers want to quit smoking, and 40% will make an attempt this year. But only between 4 and 7% can quit without support, said Jennifer Folkenroth, the National Senior Director of Tobacco Programs at the American Lung Association. Smokers and tobacco users who want to quit should make a plan to be successful, such as setting a quit date, understanding smoking triggers, talking to a doctor about quit smoking medications, and finding support through families, friends, and cessation programs, she suggested in a Lung Association news release. The Lung Association offers several tips to help you stay on track. Learn from your past experiences. If you've tried to stop smoking, chewing, or vaping before, think through what helped you then and what you'll do differently this time. Don't go it alone. Enrolling in a program such as the Lung Association's Freedom from Smoking program can increase your chances of success by about 50%. Ask friends and family for additional support to help you. Talk to your doctor. Ask about smoking cessation medications, which can double your chances of success. There are 7 federally approved options. It's important to follow directions and use the medications for the full length of the prescription. Skip the substitutes. Quit. But don't switch to e-cigarettes or other tobacco products. Quitting will mean ending your addiction to nicotine. No e-cigarette has been found to be safe by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Know that it's never too late to quit, enhancing the length and quality of your life, saving money, and possibly inspiring others. About 40 million people in America still smoke, and tobacco use remains the nation's leading cause of death. The American Lung Association, which has a new campaign called No Tobacco 22, offers a variety of resources to help people become ex-smokers, including a helpline and quit line at 1-800-LUNG-USA, staffed with nurses and certified tobacco treatment specialists. That's 1-800-LUNG-USA. And also here in Ohio, we have our own quit line that can offer you free support and referrals. In Ohio, that's 1-800-QUIT-NOW, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Okay, folks, well, that does it for the news reporting, but we still have additional bonus articles online that you can read. We have 8 of them this week. First up, doctors have an arsenal of COVID-19 treatments, but setbacks and shortages are undercutting options. 2, Omicron magnifies the distress in the healthcare labor system. 3, how to hold unvaccinated Americans accountable. 4, a black box, emergency medics remain locked out of electronic health records. And as a spoiler alert, that's not good for the medics and it's not good for doctors in the healthcare system. 5. I saw firsthand what it takes to keep COVID out of Hong Kong. It felt like a different planet. This is a nice long account of a personal experience of going back to Hong Kong and being a different world where basically they don't have COVID, but they pay a different cost as far as doing big lockdowns for people coming in the country and such. 6, the one I referenced earlier in the show, the Biden administration rejected an October proposal for free rapid tests for the holidays. Bum, 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 bum. That would have been nice. 7, the stakes at the Supreme Court's vaccine cases are even bigger than they seem. The court doesn't just threaten the public health, it threatens democracy itself, the ability to govern ourselves. And 8, as a New Year's one, the science of forming healthy habits. You can read these and the other stories that I've reported on in this show by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-